Okay, so as Leo said, that I'm the experimentalist of the week, and so the talk will have one aspect of experimental flavor. It will not have much theory, but whether it'll have much experiment or not, we'll see. So I have never given a talk on cold atoms. I should confess right away. So I have to work very hard yesterday, trying to make this talk. So it's an experiment for me in that sense. So we'll see. So what I did is I listed. And I started working on it about a year ago. And I listed all my collaborators. I've done an enormous amount of work because I managed to do what I'm very good at, which is collaborating with a large number of people. And I have done that here. It's actually, even I'm amazed how many people have collaborated in less than a year in this. So Vito Scarola's work is what I'm going to mostly describe when I tell you some substantive theoretical research. Vito is a postdoc at Maryland. Chuanwei Zhang is our atomic person. He is also a postdoc. His PhD is in atomic physics. And when I decided to do cold atoms, I realized that I cannot just take condensed matter problems and call them cold atom problems, which is what many of the condensed matter type cold atom papers are. So I decided to recruit a real atomic PhD physicist, Chuanwei Zhang from Texas, and he has been very helpful. Sumanta Tewari is doing, also a postdoc, doing some cold atom, mostly in P-wave superconductor, and I probably will not talk much about Sumanta's work. It's mostly Scarola and Chuanwei Zhang. Ian Spillman is an experimentalist who is officially an employee of NIST, but we have this joint thing with NIST called Joint Quantum Institute, like GILA, in very successful model of GILA we are trying to emulate. And Ian just accepted a permanent position, the first permanent position in this JQI. So the lab, his lab is in going to be in the university, in the physics department, but he'll be paid by the government. So it's an ideal combination. He doesn't have to, you know, put up with university nonsense. Steve Ralston is an AMO experimentalist from whom I have learned a lot. And yes, Ian's name shows up twice because he gave me several slides that I'll show. And then I have collaborated with people who are right here. They're in green. People right here. Kunjung Wu is not here today because he's in Maryland giving a talk. So he's being interviewed at Maryland. He gave the talk yesterday. Chetan is here and Leon is here. And then there are others in other institutions that I have collaborated with. Eugene Demler, Peter Zoller, Joel Moore, Vincent Liu, Senthil, and Dang Hai Li. And Matthias. I have not actually written a paper with Matthias, but I have discussed probably as much condensed AMO physics as anybody here, with the possible exception of Vito Scarola and Chuanwei Zhang. I probably discussed more AMO physics with Matthias, and I have 4 days to write a paper with you. Okay, so I'm going to show some of the results of all of these people. So first, let me start by talking. When you're talking about, my title of my talk is somewhat pretentious and somewhat ambitious. I want to talk about strong correlation physics in strongly correlated condensed matter physics on cold atom systems. So if I want to do that, first I have to talk about techniques. The techniques are very different. Experimental techniques are very different in cold atoms and condensed matter, and I must confess that I'm still learning all the experimental techniques in cold atoms. It takes a long time to learn and develop a field for cold atom, for any new field, the techniques in that field, particularly the numbers. So I kind of know what the techniques they use, but I don't have an instinctive feel for the numbers. But I want to emphasize this point, particularly for the young people, that the techniques that are used in condensed matter and AMO are very, very different. And for the young theorists, if you want to make a mark on AMO physics, think of new techniques that they can use, which can, extract information out of experiments. I think that's where some high impact work is still waiting to be done. We have done a lot of nice work translating condensed matter problems to AMO problems, but the techniques are where I think some of the breakthroughs are going to come. So in condensed matter, what are the techniques we use? And this I think is a fairly exhaustive list. We do transport. That's my favorite topic. Then we do thermodynamics, specifically susceptibility, compressibility. We do spectroscopies of all kinds, neutrons, photons, electrons, muons. Even with sound, one can do spectroscopy. We do microscopies of all kinds these days, atomic force microscopy, STM, capacitance spectroscopy, optical spectroscopy in all local probes, but we can learn a lot from those. And there are other probes and methods that I probably missed, So condensed matter is very rich in probes because if a chunk of matter, you can do many things with it, and we do. And this is, of course, the great power of condensed matter, that we can bring just on one material. If you take transport in a quantum hall, physics, something I work on extensively. You think of it as a transport problem because it's all resistance you are measuring and seeing quantization. And it's indeed true, much of quantum Hall physics is transport physics, but there are many other techniques that are brought up and to bear on quantum Hall. People do light scattering. Aaron Pinczuk does light scattering. Then there is ultrasonic attenuation. People have used various NMR technique to that. So this is the beauty of condensed matter. When you have a chunk of matter, you can do various things to it. And, you know, if you're lucky, you can learn something new. In AMO, really the only technique that one has is time of flight. And then you can look at momentum distribution. You can do noise correlation. You can do other things. But it's really time of flight. And so, you know, that's, I would say, is a big difference between between AMO and condensed matter. Of course, something like momentum distribution, we cannot directly see in condensed matter. You can do spectroscopy like ARPIS with light, and you can construct the momentum distribution function by looking at the spectral function and integrating overall frequency and so on. But there's a tremendous amount of massaging of data involved in doing that. You have to use various energy cutoff that you may not know and so on. So I do not know of any technique in condensed matter that can directly see momentum distribution. So in that sense, time of flight is a great technique. But, you know, look at all the other techniques we have. There is, as far as I know, no direct analogy of those here. But again, I'm not an expert. I may very well be making incorrect remarks, and I expect the experts here to correct me. Then there are other differences, of course, between condensed matter and atomic systems. Some of this is rather trivial, but I'll list them anyway. Our condensed matter systems are essentially infinite thermodynamic systems for all practical purposes. Microscopic length scales are, you know, many, many orders of magnitude smaller than the system size. But, of course, they're disordered. Disorder you cannot avoid. Charles already has a question. Yes?
Yes, I think they could do some spectroscopy now.
Yeah, Raman spectroscopy they can do.
Yes,
and they do, yeah. Sure. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. Those techniques are coming in. I thought whether to include them or not, but I had nothing intelligible. So what Charles is saying is that you can actually do Raman scattering and so on, but they're mostly kind of local probes. But you're right. They would not, at this stage, they don't say much about the collective properties of the condensate and so on, like they do in condensed matter. But you're right. There are a few other techniques that they use for as local probe. Now, in atomic systems, on the other hand, are finite. Of course, there could be many microscopic units, several tens of thousands. But there is one big difference, at least the optical lattice system. When I'm talking about AMO, I'm mostly thinking of optical lattice systems. They're inhomogeneous. And because you always have a trap potential in the back to keep. The trap potential may be varying very slowly or maybe varying very sharply that you control, but it's always there. You cannot do experiments without them. So whenever you're talking about studying a condensed matter problem in the atomic context, if you leave out the trap potential completely, you may be missing out some important aspect of the actual physical system. As towards the end of my talk, I'll give you one specific example. We have this prediction for supersolid. And in looking at it with Eugene Dembler in a collaboration by how one can see it in noise correlation spectroscopy, we found out that it would look like one always has a supersolid because at the edge you'll always have a superfluid. In the bulk, you can have some not insulated look like the system has a supersolid, whereas in reality, it's just an effect of the trap potential. So one would conclude something incorrect. One would conclude one is seeing a new phase of matter. In reality, it's just, I mean, I don't want to say it's just. It's an important, interesting effect. But it's not what you think naively if you just do the experiment. Many condensed matter papers actually completely leave out this trap potential effect because, of course, our Hamiltonian doesn't have that. Our Hamiltonian does not have the slowly varying background potential confining the system. And in some problems, that's fine. Some problems you're studying, the fact that the system is inhomogeneous doesn't matter at all, but other problems it may matter. And I would say that condensed matter types, you know, they are the ones I'm really speaking to, need to worry about it on a case-by-case basis, just as we do in our condensed matter problem. You know, most condensed matter problems we study assuming there is no disorder, but you always have disorder, right? But we know in which problem we can keep disorder and which problem we cannot, whether neglecting disorder is a fundamentally bad approximation or just a quantitative approximation. We know from our intuition and from thinking it's the same here. So whether the inhomogeneity in the system arising from the trap and the fact there is a well-defined edge is important or not, has to be thought through carefully in each experimental setup. And I think this is the fundamental, at least technical difference in thinking about theory between CM and AMO.
Shekhar?
Yes.
So you said it was important and interesting. Can you give me an example where it's interesting?
Well, this paper, I'll come to that. That's the end.
Important,
we have this paper where we find there could be a chiral edge state which could have some non-abelian property. I mean, this is a paper we posted, and so basically, if you are studying some edge properties which are interesting, there it's interesting, okay. But it's like quantum Hall edge is interesting because there is some fundamental significance of the edge. So only in that sense. Otherwise, it's like disorder. If you're trying to study anything else, it's just a bad thing. Okay, particularly if quantum phase diagram is what you're after.
Even disorder in infinite systems that have interesting physics associated with it.
Yeah.
And what actually, I think there are cases that is actually of crucial importance. I think, especially now for this workshop, we're talking about going into a strong color regime. It's also the issue of cooling is very important. Now, if you have a trap, then you have these plateaus.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, then you ask where the entropy is. If you have just about phase, entropy is actually zero. But then once you have this step, that's all the entropy is, and then there it's now a bottleneck. It's a very serious problem. If you ask me how much temperature that you need to go down to go to T square over U, for example, and then you have all this entropy around. So I think these are very serious. Turns out. In this case, are very serious issues.
So this actually goes back to what Leon was saying, that I think he doesn't disagree there are serious issues, but that's a problem we have to deal with, but it's not necessarily an interesting physics in itself.
It could be interesting.
Everything that makes helium-3 works is a Pomerantz cooling.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's a simple physics,
okay.
but a powerful piece of physics.
Right,
here,
it doesn't work.
I
agree. I completely agree. And now Jason has brought up a very important point, which I should have had in capital letters, that the temperature of these AMO systems in general is not known. This is something I did not know until a couple of months ago when I started writing a proposal with Bill Phillips. They don't know the temperature. No, I mean, they just don't know the temperature. It's pretty amazing from a condensed matter viewpoint. I mean, people like Matthias, I guess, knew this, ever since he was a baby. I didn't. I said, well, how can you talk about phase diagram if you don't know the temperature? So we don't know the temperature. I mean, they're just completely calm about it. And one of the reasons is what you pointed out, and also they don't have any probe, really, to directly measure the temperature. Thermometry is difficult, even in condensed matter, below millikelvin, because, to do thermometry, you need a probe which you have somehow calibrated. So measuring temperature is, of course, non-trivial at very low temperature. But here they have additional problems, one of which Jason alluded to. This may turn out to be a very big problem in talking about quantum phase diagram of AMO systems. And I'm not going to talk about it later on, this temperature issue, because I do not have many important or deep things to say. But what Matthias and I are thinking about, actually rather seriously, to use theory to figure out temperature. That means you get the quantum phase diagram at many different temperatures, compare it with experimental data and see, because we do have this great advantage that the Hamiltonian is precise. So what I'm saying here is that, so in condensed matter systems, in general, we do not know the Hamiltonian, right? So all condensed matter problems when we study, except with the exception of quantum Hall effect, it's a model Hamiltonian. When we say high TC is described by 2D Hubbard model, it's a model. High TC obviously is not described by 2D Hubbard model if you're interested in everything, but we hope that some universal aspects of it or some quantum critical aspects of it are described by 2D Hubbard model. So in general, condensed matter Hamiltonians for complex problems are not known, okay? And that's why we build models, and a lot of ingenuity goes into building models. On the other hand, as we know, AMO system, the Hamiltonian is precise. You have somehow built the Hamiltonian to follow your model, and that's, of course, why you are all attracted to it, with the caveat that it's finite and homogeneous. So if the Hamiltonian is really precise, suppose I have a piece of AMO system, I'm absolutely convinced this is the Hamiltonian, and I get the phases, then of course we can invert that and get some temperature from that. It's a lot of work. But they do not know the temperature. I mean, I don't know if somebody in the audience wants to make some comment on it. I find this very disturbing.
You're also assuming it's in equilibrium.
Yeah, that's of course. I mean, that's even worse. What you're saying, temperature may not even be defined. Okay, I mean, that's even a larger issue than if the temperature is not defined, you cannot talk about a temperature at all. And these are issues I think we have to seriously confront. And again, you know, the subject is only beginning.
When you say it's a precisely known Hamiltonian, that's also a theoretical assumption. I mean, people think that, but I don't know what these
this are. One, yes, I mean, absolutely, that is a theoretical wishful thinking, but I think it's valid much more in those systems, AMO systems, than in condensed matter systems. And in fact, the current push to actually quantitatively determine a quantum phase diagram and compare it will tell us to what extent it's true. Okay, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. I believe that certainly Bose-Hubbard model probably describes the bosonic AMO systems much better than it describes any condensed matter system. But we'll know in the next 2 to 3 years, we'll know precisely by looking at the phase diagram. And I'll come back to this point. Okay, this will be one of the things I'll discuss. So, and finally, of course, the AMO systems have something that in condensed matter we only wish we can. They have real quantum coherence. You know, the system is really a quantum coherent system. And that allows various things like, for example, if you're interested in macroscopic quantum effect like Schrodinger cat state or quantum computation, perhaps these systems are much better off than condensed matter systems, as long as you're not talking about scaling up to, you know, many thousands of microscopic units, many thousands of so-called qubits or cat state involving, you know, many entangled microscopic states. I think that people have built states which are you know, 7 or 8 microscopic or larger. But quantum coherence is a real plus of this AMO system that we do not have to that extent in condensed matter system. So I'm not going to say much about AMO part of it, but I want to go back and I want to say that it's very important that people think about young people, again, young condensed matter people, think of experimental tools, even as a matter of principle, for studying AMO system. And, you know, one of the more important contributions made by condensed matter people here is the work from work of Ehud Altman et al. At Harvard, where they proposed noise correlation as a tool in AMO system, you know, which is used in a routine manner in mesoscopic system, but then they propose it can be used in AMO system also. And this is a very highly cited paper for a very good reason, is that it's kind of a new tool. It's not a completely new tool because it's still time of flight, but kind of a new tool. So I have been actually working and looking at various aspects of atomic physics to see if one can talk about experimental tools. And in fact, almost all of them are local probes, really looking at one or two atoms, because the context of some of these things are quantum computation or topological quantum computation. I'm not going to discuss these things, but if there are people who are interested, I'll be happy to talk to you afterwards, because each of these is quite technical and involves a lot of atomic physics, which I'm really not even an expert. And they involve a lot of Raman scattering, local microspectroscopy, bringing a lot of different tools together to study single atomic states in AMO physics. And this sort of thing, I think, which is atomic physics, I think condensed matter types will have to worry about. If you expect atomic experimentalists to listen to you and actually look at the exotic phase that you have proposed, you have to speak the language, and you know, I'm trying to learn that language. Or, of course, you can collaborate with Peter Zoller. That will work also. He will convert into the correct language. So what are the various cold atom condensed matter phenomena that people talk about? The number is huge. If you look at physical few letters, you'll find a large number of very interesting predictions of various condensed matter phenomena that people should be able to see in cold atom systems. And the list is very long, and I'm going to first talk about the ones that has already happened. Of course, it started with Bose-Einstein condensation in 1995. And Bose-Einstein condensation is a fantastic experimental discovery, absolutely beautiful. But theoretically, of course, it's something nobody questioned. It's undergraduate physics. You know, it's 8 years old because it's just very difficult to actually do it. But there are interesting non-equilibrium aspects, but just the phenomenon itself is very well understood theoretically. Then in cold atom system, particularly the NIST group, Bill Phillips' group, has done beautiful work looking at things like Bloch oscillations. You know, Bloch oscillation is that if you have a periodic potential, this is, I guess, Felix Bloch talked about it in early 30s, if a periodic potential, then as an electron, let's say, Bloch talked about electron, is moving in this periodic potential, it comes to the end of the Brillouin zone, it can tunnel back. And you have this quantum oscillation in time-space, and it has never been seen in condensed matter system. It's a very simple prediction. It's just the same periodicity that you have in real space, time-space, and the thing should oscillate. And this block oscillation in condensed matter system has not been seen because we have disorder, and our scattering time, broadening due to scattering, is essentially always larger than the block oscillation period. And so the system is always overdamped. So you cannot see. There are some indications. For example, Jim Allen here in the physics department has done some frequency domain spectroscopy where there are indications that block oscillations are there, but you never see even one full oscillation in condensed matter system because it's just damped. These systems are highly coherent, so block oscillation is seen, Phillips tells me, routinely. It's very beautiful measurements. Again, simple one-electron physics, but has not happened in condensed matter system. So all of Kittel textbook things you can do very beautiful in this system. Yes?
But in Josephson junctions, like single Cooper pair box.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I should have mentioned. No. Look, I mean, I'm not putting this up as something great new thing. Again, it's something you expect. But since I come from semiconductor background, where, as you know, super lattice was originally proposed by Leo Esaki to see block oscillation. If you go back to the original paper, it has not been seen in solid state semiconductor system, but you are right. It has been seen in the system in Josephson junction.
Has it been seen in super lattices?
No. The best is some frequency domain spectroscopy, where you translate it and say, what kind of frequency response do I get in a heavily damped block oscillating system, and then you interpret. But nice oscillation in time, no. Because if you just estimate the, it's all gamma is larger than omega. 1 over tau, h bar over tau is much, much larger than omega. So even if it oscillates, it's, you know, less than one oscillation. And people have not given up. People are still trying. But because it has device implications, because if you do it, you can create high frequency. Yeah. And so, you know, so there is a large effort in Sandia National Lab to do it. But you need very pure material, and I'm not sure it's going to happen. Now, of course, the thing that attracted the attention of a large fraction of condensed matter types is that in Emmanuel Bloch's group, they realized Bose-Hubbard model using BECs on optical lattices and saw MOT insulator to superfluid crossover. I would say the actual phase transition, the critical, it should, in an ideal system, be a first order transition. That has probably not been seen, but again, people of goodwill could kind of disagree. I think we'll have a lot of discussion on that. But definitely both phases have been seen, MOT insulator and superfluid, and I'm going to show you a lot of results on that. And BCS, I'm not going to talk much about fermions. I'm going to show you some theoretical papers, but when I actually discuss systems, I'm going to talk mostly about Bose-Hubbard system, because I have done some work using fermions, but I have not looked at the experimental papers on fermions at all. But BCS, BEC crossover has certainly been seen, and some leading experts in that subject are sitting in the audience, and I'm sure you'll have a lot of talks. And my understanding is that what has been seen so far, and, you know, Jason, Leo, you should correct me, all this very interesting, very beautiful, it's something in condensed matter theoretically has been worked out, meaning there is no surprise there that we did not know in principle.
I agree with you. However, I think it actually amazes me, maybe not other people, that the crossover theory worked so well. In the same way, the history is that I think before it was found, and there are speculations, including Tony Neckett himself, that actually the whole thing may fail at the resonance regions because there are so much fluctuation.
Yep.
that might not have mm-hmm. taken things properly into account, and the nature, but nature just speak otherwise. So that theory works.
These experiments are beautiful, and the fact that theory works is, you know, awe-inspiring. And maybe they will see things down the line that would not be described, let's hope, by theories we already know. But the point I'm making here is, you know, this is an important point to make, that these four things that you see here, and there may be other examples, I'm using the four that came to my mind late last night as I was preparing this slide. They're beautiful experimental achievements, you know, absolutely fantastic experimental achievements. But if I want to make an extreme statement, which I'm known to make, then theoretically, they're exactly what you'd expect, the textbook stuff theoretically. Now, often theoretical textbook stuff do not occur in nature exactly in the textbook manner, but here it does. So maybe we should be, you know, maybe it is kind of awe-inspiring. But if you're a pure, you know.
When you said it works extremely well,
yeah.
The BCS-BEC crossover, mm-hmm. In an earlier transparency, Shankar said there weren't many, only one experimental probe anyway. So what do you mean when you say that it works extremely well? What are you comparing with?
It's just, and you better answer this question.
Well, I wasn't thinking about interrupting Shankar, because he gave really excellent, with a very excellent introduction.
Oh, he's going to say something bad about me. He's setting me up.
there are more hope than that. There are, in fact, the things, what was spectroscopy, there are spectroscopy, which measure the gaps, and there are collective modes.
Right,
and the measure, there's a whole host of measurements, and which are all consistent with the causal picture, and not only that, they are all tied together by a phenomenon called some universal properties, and basically, if you know one experiment, you can infer what would happen in the other experiment. So in that sense, work very well. They also phase bound work very well, but there's still a lot of things not understood. The transport is not understood at all. There's a great mystery why certain things behave a certain way. And at the moment, they are beginning to be really puzzles.
Yeah.
The transport is very beautiful results, but it's not understood at the moment.
I mean, I certainly hope that you'll have lots of talks and discussion on the fermionic system where BCS, BC crossover.
There are actually transport measurements in the system?
Well, the transport is a damping of the mode, basically.
Again, time of flight.
Behavior, but it's not the, yeah.
So you move it and then do time of flight. Now I'm in red, I'm talking about some of the things that have been predicted but have not been seen. And here I'm going to be extremely parochial, only talk about things that I have predicted and have not been seen. Okay, because there are just too many predictions in the subject to list all of them. In fact, there are too many predictions by me to list all of them, okay? So the situation is that bad. Because almost anything you could think of probably in AMO system can be done at some level. Whether they can study all the details or not, I do not know. So, you know, I showed you that I have had many collaborators. So, of course, we have been busy. We have produced lots of results. So we have predicted that, you know, super solid may be observable in a Bose-Hubbard model if you can go beyond on-site interaction, if you can have a longer range interaction. And this work was actually motivated by work at Station Q here. Station Q, I guess, still was in Redmond, where there were proposals that you could have a topological phase if you have extended Hubbard model. And we were actually looking for these topological phases. And we actually could not create the kind of Hubbard model you need to see a topological phase. We have not given up, but it's looking more and more unlikely. But we did get a super solid as a side benefit of that study. Then the PUF superfluid, and there are others in this room, Leo and Victor, they have worked on it also. In fact, they worked before us on talking about the possibility of using PUF Fishback resonance, having a P-wave superconducting superfluid system in atomic cold atomic gases. And what we have recently shown is that if you have that, then in principle you can study non-abelian nature of these Majorana modes that you'd have in a P-wave system. Then you can perhaps create emulated Kitaev lattice. This was shown by Duan and Demler and Lukin, how you can create a Kitaev lattice by very complicated 6 laser patterns, but in principle workable. And we recently showed how you can do anionic braiding in this Kitaev lattice using, in fact, some of the techniques that Jason was talking about, RF mostly and Raman, local Raman scattering. Very recently in a paper with Senthil, we showed that you can create an artificial pyrochlore lattice. This is a direct product of KITP, the topological program. Senthil was giving a talk on topological phase, and over lunch we realized that it's an absolute literal statement. Over lunch we realized that one can create a pyrochlore artificial system where some of these gauge modes that Xiaogang Wen has been talking about should be accessible. Kongjung Wu, who is here at KITP in a collaboration, it's really his work. I mean, I'm a very minor collaborator, found a quantum strife phase in some situation, a true quantum stripe. You know, in condensed matter, we are very used to stripes. Stripes are dime a dozen in condensed matter. But almost all stripes in condensed matter arise from long-range Coulomb interaction. It's competition between something long-range and something short-range. But this was different. This is really a quantum stripe. And I Konjung, I think, gave a talk last week. I hope he talked about it. And then there is another work, Konjung Wu, in which Leon is involved also. Joel Mood was involved in this too. And this is flat band. And we found a system which will have flat bands, and when you have flat band, that means kinetic energy is basically quenched, so then interaction energy will do important things, and that's how Laughlin liquid state came up, right? But we have not been able to find a Laughlin liquid state, but we have been able to find some Wigner crystal state. So all these, we think, in principle, can be done on cold atom systems, and there are many, many other predictions by others which I have not listed, and you know they will get opportunity to talk about that. And the problem is that it's very, you know, I don't want to say it's very easy, but it's possible to make predictions for various phases in cold atom systems, because even if you're very serious as a theorist, you are doing essentially two things. One is you're finding a suitable Hamiltonian whose properties you think you know or your friends know very well in the condensed matter context. And then you translate that to optical lattice, which you do. And then if you're serious, you do a second step. Then you also kind of construct, you do a theoretical construction of this optical lattice, which involves knowing some aspects of laser physics and how they should be combined. And that's where, as theorists, we stop. And then you may have some statements about what time of flight will see, and some little signal will be the signature of your phase. The problem is all these experiments are very, very hard. The temperature is not known, and so on. So if you want to convince experimentalists that they should really look for these phases, you have to do more work, which is what I'm finding out. So, you know, and I think this, I'm hoping this workshop will lead to work like that, you know, serious work, which will induce AMO experimentalists to look for phases you're talking about. And one phase that I have been involved with where some experimentalists have shown some interest is this Bose-Haber supersolid phase. So I'm going to talk about that in some details after this preliminary introduction. Let me also tell you, because I'm not going to come back to this point, is that what it seems to be many experimentalists in this field want to know, again, Matthias is very intimately involved in that, is that they want to create a 2D Hubbard model, fermionic Hubbard model. That's the big goal, okay? Emulating 2D Hubbard model is the big goal here, and we all know why, right? That's high temperature superconductor and so on and so forth, and there will be a lot of work in the next 5 years on a very, very concerted, narrowly focused effort on 2D Hubbard model in optical lattice. So the reason is very simple. Federal government is putting a lot of money in this particular problem, okay? And the best groups will get a lot of funding, many millions of dollars, to do these experiments. And so if you are looking for a good problem to work on, but the experimental data are still not available, think of non-trivial aspects of 2D Hubbard model as applied to cold atom systems. And it cannot be just translating the model or saying, making some statements about its results. Those things are known. You know, what can experimentalists do with respect to temperature? You know, what can experimentalists do to see the actual phases? Remember, the phases are not very well known. I personally will be absolutely delighted if this big effort over the next 5 years on 2D Hubbard model leads to two results. A, 2D Hubbard model does or does not have superconductivity, okay? Definitively. Item number one. Item number two, if it does not have superconductivity, definitely shown, that's tremendous advance. You know, basically puts the whole condensed matter community to shame for thinking that is the solution of ITC.
It's very hard to predict that.
No, I'm not saying predicting. I'm saying, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I'll be very happy if one of these two results come out.
I mean, what I mean is that it's very hard to make such statements, so to say that there's no superconductivity.
No, if it's at incredibly low temperature, it doesn't matter. You know, incredibly low temperature compared with the system parameters. It doesn't have superfluidity at quote-unquote high temperature. That's what I mean, okay? Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. Even electron gas probably goes superconducting due to Cohn-Luttinger superconductivity, you know, at some very low temperature. But I mean, not at any reasonable temperature compared with the units of your... And the second is, if it is, whether it's D-wave or not. You know, and I think these two are not absurd goals. You know, whole phase diagram, I think, would be very difficult. And you know, the point I'm making here is that there'll be enormous experimental efforts worldwide on this problem over the next 5 years. Right, Matthias? I mean,
What was item B?
Item B is that if the ground state is superconducting at reasonable temperature, is it D wave or not? Okay, because high TC is D wave. That's more or less well established. You know, so if it has superconductivity but is definitely not D wave, then it's not solving high TC problem. So I'm just going to very quickly go through some of these things I talked about. Said,
how can it be S wave?
I didn't say it's S wave. I mean, if it's D wave. I said if it's D wave or not. I mean it probably cannot be S wave.
What is it?
Oh, sorry, the electron dope high TC materials may be S wave.
No, now nobody believes that either. There were early claims of that, but now even the Maryland group, which claimed that, they all think it's the same. You are right. But it would be nice to have direct experimental verification of what the symmetries, orbital symmetries, in a Hubbard model. I mean, superconductor, you already know it's D wave, right? I'm not disagreeing with you, but if you already think that there is superconductivity, as Charles was saying, and you say it's D wave, then you should not even tackle the problem. Look, there are a lot of reasonable people, not in this country perhaps, who think it's not even an electronic mechanism, including the person who invented or discovered the high TC, right? I mean, Alex Muller believes it's some kind of polaron or phonon. I mean, it's a serious question. And so I think it's an important issue. How much you'll discover, I do not know. So, you know, this is Conjing Wu's work, and he talked about it last week. I saw on the web, so I'm not going to say anything about it. And basically, he found a way of creating, you know, honeycomb optical lattice. At least two co-authors of mine are sitting in the audience. And we showed that this is not only doing artificial Dirac cone physics, graphene physics without disorder. And I think the Dirac cone physics in graphene would be very hard to access because of disorder. And I think that the actual Dirac cone physics is all dominated by disorder and real graphene. But in this system, of course, one doesn't have any disorder. So maybe Dirac cone physics will be accessed more easily in this flat band system. I'm not going to say much more about that. So this is a paper where we showed, using actually local RF and Raman and microwave technique, how you can, once you form a Kitaev lattice, using this technique that the Harvard collaboration pointed out, in that Kitaev lattice, how you can do various braiding that you need to do elementary topological operations. I mean, this is really pure atomic physics. It's a manipulation of laser light, and this is mainly Chuan Wei Zhang's work. Very complicated, but as a matter of principle, it turns out that you can do all the things that Alexei Kitaev proposed, which I think in real semiconductor systems or magnetic systems is, first, we do not have a system like that which obeys Kitaev's Hamiltonian, and second, even if there is, I don't see any way right now of manipulating states to do the braiding. But here, in principle, it's possible. It's very hard, I should tell you that. But in principle, it's possible. All these papers are on the web, so I did not give you that. More than half of them are published. This is something I'm going to talk about later, and this comes back to this issue of having an edge. If you have an edge, what we are trying to do here is, again, look for the super solid phase, and then you realize that everything is totally dominated by edge effects, and then we try to put this disadvantage into an advantage, and we started looking at the edge current, and this is something they're trying to see at NIST. And we found that this edge problem has a chirality, so you can associate a Chern number to it, and there's certain topological invariance. There's a persistent current. The whole thing is like a big molecule. It's coherent, right? So the whole thing is like a big molecule. So if a big molecule, you'll have a diamagnetic response, and that diamagnetic response is really concentrated at the edge, and there are some topological invariance in it which you can study. I'm going to come back to that. And then there are this series of papers we have on talking about P-wave atomic systems. Our original motivation was Strontium-Ruthenite. Strontium-Ruthenite, the solid state system, is a chiral P-wave superconductor. Now it's established. Experiments from Stanford, Aharon Kapitulnik, and from Illinois, Dale Van Harlingen, have shown over the last 6 months that it's chiral, time reversal invariance is spontaneously broken, and it's P-wave superconductor. And so, yeah.
One is what Aharon
did is he did his famous experiment which showed that anionic superconductivity doesn't apply to high TC. So he did the same Kerr spectroscopy, and it's a beautiful experiment. It got written up in Physics Today a month ago, and he did the same experiment that nullified anionic superconductivity show that here the time reversal invariance is broken. Very beautiful, precise experiment. And Del Van Hardingen did one of his squid measurements to look at the symmetry. And so one came out in physics later, one came out in science. And so I think now strontium ruthenate is established as a chiral pure superconductor. And so the question is, can you see the Majorana modes? Can you stabilize half vortices?
They have a single domain or not single domain?
Well, the domain is a problem. They do not have single domain yet. Yeah. But, you know, this is, as you know, materials development and so on, right? So but motivated by that, you know, several of us, including our two leaders of this program, we have started looking at the possibility of creating PUF superconductor in atomic atomic systems, where you would not have domain and other problems. And again, this is a very active subject, and I'm not going to talk much about it, because you know the problem is that here, although it's called a cold atom problem, this come out in the physical review later in the general physics section, this is really condensed matter physics we are doing. Okay, I mean we really do not have many sharp and smart things to say about what the experimentalists should do. You know, we do some noise. We ourselves at Maryland have done some noise calculation and, you know, kind of claim there should be a signal, but I suspect the signal will be very small and so on. So there are really no good outstanding ideas. There was a paper from Eugene Dembler saying that you can do STM in strontium ruthenate, but I don't think that's going to really work. So there are questions here as far as atomic physics goes, but it's a, I think, beautiful and just beginning subject. Again, young people should think about it.
Shankar, yes. You've mainly emphasized the kind of signatures you can look for, but what are the ideas as far as actually making systems that should be, and just because it's P wave doesn't mean it's going to be the
no, general P wave. So this paper of ours, the one with Peter Zoller, where is that one? This one, we actually construct the, you know, Chuan-Wei Zhang, our laser, we actually construct the system. It's very difficult. Okay. But we actually show how to construct the system.
And can you say simply, what it is that would actually ensure you have a chiral P wave?
It turns out that the chirality is not that important once you're in a cold atom system.
Well, I mean, I'm just comparing it to a regular, PX plus PY superconductor or something that doesn't have time reversal symmetry. I mean, all these signatures you're talking about are due to time reversal symmetry.
No, not all, but some of them are. So the chirality will come from the way you are setting up the laser, and it's whether it can be done or not. I mean, the reason I'm not talking about it is that I think from atomic perspective, I mean, maybe Victor and Leo could add something. It's going to be a very difficult task.
Okay. So Victor and I studied this extensively.
They have
in Feshbach resonance systems, and so there the phase that you get is indeed PX plus IPY thing. So you need to do P wave with identical atoms, so that they automatically just polarize. So you compare it with helium, the spin is polarized, and then the dominant part of the phase diagram is the PX plus IPY.
Okay. So that's different than helium. You're saying that region of the phase diagram really expands. So,
So that part we just cite their paper, because they already showed that you can make this in principle. And then the optical lattice part, you have to have laser thing. But, you know, this is, again, not too many atomic physicists are running out to kind of do it, because it's very difficult. We have to do more work to make them try it. I don't know if people in GILA are trying. We can our NIST friends or Tillman Estinger, they're not interested.
I mean, they're having trouble with a three-body collision, as far as I understand. But so Debbie Jin has demonstrated P-wave Feshbach resonances, but actually, and they can make molecules, but not reversibly. They lose them. They can't convert them back into atoms.
So Debbie Jin is still trying to do this, and this is like a project.
They're ongoing experiments.
Oh, good. And this, this tripodering is, again, if it can be seen, is interesting. It will have some signature in noise correlation. But the reservation syncretism I applied to overall condensed matter work, in this whole AMO field applies to this our work also, that from a condensed matter viewpoint, it looks very interesting. But if you talk to AMO experimentalists, they're not convinced they should put a lot of energy in doing it. And I don't blame them, because each of these things is very difficult. And this one is realizing one of these various models, exotic models, that are very popular at KITP, Santa Barbara, and in MIT. And whose experimental realization is not easy. Whose experimental realization is not easy. Let me just leave it there, okay? In condensed matter system. I mean, there are telltale signs in various materials that maybe one is seeing this physics, but in condensed matter system, you have the problem. You can never be sure the Hamiltonian you're working with applies. Here, we, of course, did it the other way around. We created the pyrochlore Hamiltonian. This was actually, you know, a lot of work by these two guys, Sumant and Vito, to create it. And we had lots and lots of this. We're all at KITP. This should make David very happy. This could not have happened except for KITP. This is just a matter of fact. We were here for a week, and we worked hard every day, and it worked. Of course, what it is good for, I don't know. Maybe just a PRL.
But what was done? What did you guys do?
Oh, we actually constructed a pyrochlore lattice, showed, you know, how you can construct it, and then that you can map the Hamiltonian on there. It's like any other thing in this business.
What's the meaning of artificial
photons? Say it again?
What's the meaning of artificial photons?
Oh, this is, I don't want to give a talk on exotic thing. This is what Xiaogang Wen has been talking about. He called that emergence of light. We put the word artificial there.
By the same meaning as what?
Right. It's exactly the same thing, right. So this is, now I'm going to talk a little bit about Bose-Hubbard model, and then we are done. You know, as I said, I'm going to, you know, my job is to say how you can do strong correlation on cold atom system, not give you lots of results on a specific model. So this is the famous experimental results of Bose-Einstein condensation. You're really looking at momentum distribution. You're really looking at the macroscopic occupancy of the lowest state. This is the original paper, I think. And then combining that with optical lattices, we have a lot of new physics started happening within 5 years of this Bose-Einstein condensation. So when you have optical lattices by various lasers coming in and trapping the atoms, you can now tune the interaction effect by varying laser intensity. So this was a breakthrough, okay, which started. So you have now two things. And the important thing to realize from condensed matter perspective that you can, by controlling the height of these laser intensity, you control the hopping T, but you also change U somewhat, but not by a very large amount. And these things are known. You can calculate. You can directly translate lattice depth into T and also into U. U changes a little bit, but not much, but T you can control completely. And so now you can see that you can now vary one of the parameters which will control your quantum phase diagram. And that was done. And this is, I guess, Marcus Greiner's famous thesis. And you see beautiful superfluid and Mott false color picture. But it is really like that. So this is, I would say, the real beginning of condensed matter AMO physics. This is 2019-99 famous Nature cover. Local Bose-Hubbard model is kind of known and so on.
2002.
Okay, 2002. Okay, yeah. So you know the thing here is that the reason it absolutely fascinated condensed matter types, the Hamiltonian and its phase diagram was kind of known. It's Matthew Fisher et al.'s very famous work in 1990. But the fact that it can be seen this spectacularly was not known, because in condensed matter system we have a lot of disorder. So you have to talk about Bose glass and all these other things which complicate life enormously. And here, you have a pristine Hamiltonian, or so we thought in the beginning, where you are just tuning the parameter T going through the phase diagram, and this is direct quantitative, what Marcus Greiner measured. So you are going from somewhere here, somewhere between this and this, these two, you know, you are going from a superfluid to a Mott phase. Now the problem is exactly where you do not know from this picture. You have to do more work. And in fact, one thing that has not happened yet, although many, many figures like this exist, so not many groups have data this beautiful. Marcus Greiner's group has it. Now Ian Spillman in NIST has it. Matthias, does anybody else have such beautiful Bose-Hubbard phase results? MIT must have it, even if they did not. ETA Zurich. So four. So it's, you know, this is not easy stuff. This is very difficult, beautiful stuff. But if you ask, what exactly is the phase transition? Well, you can't really say. You have to look at visibility. And interesting thing is that although this is 5 years old now, 2002, this beautiful data, if you look for, as I did, just to prepare for this talk, that has anybody put these points really on a phase diagram, The answer is not really. I mean, Mathias may have done it to his student, unpublished, and so on. You, whenever people talk about it, experimenters give talk, they always show things like this. Very recently, Jan Spielman has tried to put, you know, question is, where is the phase transition here? Or if you may have an error bar, some kind of blob, can you put that on the actual phase diagram? And you know, and it, when you start doing it, then you suddenly realize that all these problems you're discussing before, inhomogeneity, even forget about temperature, let's say it's equal to zero, inhomogeneity immediately becomes a problem, okay, because you are really not talking about a chemical potential, you're talking about a density, and some of these issues, I think, need to be settled. So,
what's the axis on the previous slide? So, we're saying about zero EUV coil on 22.
This is just the recoil energy that's changing.
No, that's the depth of the potential.
Yeah, so you're changing, say, just changing T. All that is changing is T, and they know exactly how T is changing. Okay? They know exactly how T is changing. That's the important point. So you think that naively, when I show the phase diagram, you're changing T. And you should be able to really point out where, but it's not so simple. So, you know, so the basic picture, of course, is very simple, right? You have a superfluid when T is much, much larger than U. And you have a Mott insular T, yeah, it's 2001, 2002. Mott insular T is much, much less than U, and so this is, you know, this is just taken two things from that picture. And you know that over here you are here, over here you are here, but this would not allow you to really draw a point on the quantum phase diagram. And then I mentioned about this noise correlation, which was proposed by Altman, Daimler, and Lukin, where they showed that by looking at noise correlation, so, you know, from a mesoscopic viewpoint, this is something we kind of know, that if you now, instead of just looking at momentum distribution, if you look at a correlator, then you learn more. But here also, the signal is very weak because of this inhomogeneity problem and so on. And although at first everybody thought this will just be a panacea, everything will get resolved once you look at noise correlation, when you start trying to do it in a real system, taking into account the trap potential, at least we found that it's not a tremendous improvement on what you already have. Is that a correct characterization? I mean, you know, that you do not really learn much more than what you learn from looking just at momentum distribution. You learn a few extra features. I mean, you have not looked at noise correlation in any depth there. We worked on it very hard for the super solid, and it really. So this is Jan Spielman's work. I think Jan will be here, and he was very kind to give me some many of his slides. I'm not going to show too many of them since he'll be here himself. So this answers the question I was bringing up, that if you look at momentum distribution versus noise correlation, so momentum distribution, this is your superfluid, this is your Mott insulator, and well, noise correlation, you know, I mean, it's whether this is much sharper than this or not, is not clear. I mean, it's whether it's giving you much more information or not, it actually is if you do a lot of analysis, which I'm not going to do which I'm not capable of doing either.
So in this case, how many atoms per minimum of the potential are we talking about?
You know what? I didn't ask him that. It's many. It's three or four.
You've got the three layers.
Yeah.
It's more homogeneous in the plane.
That's correct. It's more homogeneous. That's the new trick he came up with. Yeah.
So he just slices someone.
He slices it exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what he does. Yeah.
Pancakes. So do you remember how many
Mott
layer he has?
No, I do not. We can look up on this in this paper. It's coming out in PRL. I don't remember.
You can see that the noise usually the signal is very weak. The kind of minus three. The other one is of the order this one. So
that's absolutely correct.
The picture that is very misleading because they enhance the.
Sure, they do false color thing, right? Right. I mean, he will improve these things, but the point is that. People I have talked to are skeptical that this is going to lead to, you know, tremendous breakthrough in looking at things.
But is this an average over some column density over many of these pancakes?
Yes, it is an average. I'll show you that in a minute. So, because single pancake, I think the signal is just too weak to see anything. Doesn't see anything.
Because then if they're not locked, I don't really know.
Yeah, I simply don't know much more than what you are looking at. So that's why I was asking if Ian is going to come here. So I do not feel like I did not study the paper. You know, So he will come and explain these things to you. This is, let's look at it as a. So this is the famous. So this is, of course, the famous phase diagram. You know, if you do not remember, of the on-site Bose-Hubbard model, you have the superfluid phase basically everywhere, and then you have this locked moth phases. And the problem basically is that you do not work with chemical potential; you work with density. So as this, I downloaded it from Marcus Greiner's thesis. By the way, anybody, any young person who wants to work in this field should definitely study Marcus Greiner's thesis. It's a masterpiece of both how, you know, how well written a thesis can be and just beautiful results. It's available on the web. You should download it and study it very carefully. There is tremendous amount of stuff there which is very, very nice. So what this picture is showing, again, experts know this, is basically most of the states are superfluid. You really have to do work to get in the Mount Insular because you need this commensuration. And because of inhomogeneity, it's a very technically demanding question because you're working with density. You do not work by changing T at some fixed mu. You have to convert. And you have to hit the right number per minima to get into the moth phase. Otherwise, what would happen? You'll just always be superfluid. It'll always go in between. So when one talks about phase diagram, it's in condensed matter, we'll think, oh, well, you just go at some, you know, fixed value of J like this or some fixed value of mu like this and just take many runs like that. But that's not the way these experiments are done. So converting what they do into a phase diagram, it requires some knowledge that may not be available. So ideally, this is something Vito Scarola made for me just for this talk. So Vito and I have been talking, and I've been discussing with Matthias loosely also, what would be the best way of depicting these phase diagrams from a condensed matter viewpoint? And I think that this is what we have come up with tentatively at this stage, that you definitely need a three-dimensional phase diagram. So you have your basic phase diagram, which is T versus mu. And we can take the density, convert that into mu. That's not a problem. Experimental density, convert that into mu, because we know all the parameters of the Hamiltonian. So that's this two-dimensional phase diagram that I have been talking about, you know, things like this. So that's in this plane now. But that doesn't tell us the whole story, because you need to know what the visibility is. So you need to plot something else along the z-axis, which will tell us, since it's an inhomogeneous system, which will tell us what the visibility is, some other experimental signature of the phase. Okay? So it could be, for example, noise correlation. So you see the noise signal will move in some particular, it will change in some particular manner. So this is what we're trying to say. This is like if you're going along this line, okay? If you're going along this line, deep into the moth phase, your noise signal will be small. Then, and this is taken from Ian Spielman's actual data. Again, I do not know the answer to averaging and those things, so I'm sorry about that. But you can see that obviously there is averaging. That's what that's what that width is coming from. And then as you approach the superfluid phase, the signal will go up. And if you plot that explicitly in the third axis, and I think, Matthias, this is one of the ways we are going to do our phase diagram. I think you have something very similar in mind, and Vito did a lot of work just before I came to produce this. If we could put that along the z-axis, then we have something like a phase diagram. Okay? Yes?
Is that data at fixed mu, or is it at fixed?
No, that's why we did not kind of put it here. You have to convert that. You know, it's probably the density change. We did not put it here. What you're saying, this is, think of this as schematic. Okay?
Okay?
Okay, so I'm saying, otherwise I'll just give you the phase diagram. That will involve some numerical work, which we, you know, this is something he gave me just before we came. We'll do it. This will be published, you know, because nobody has done it. I asked Matthias, nobody has done it. I mean, you are Marcus Greiner and only two who could have done it. But it's some work. Each point you have to convert exactly as you are asking. So
each point will correct from the many points in the phase diagram.
That's correct. Yes, absolutely correct. Yes.
Well, you're also assuming that it's coming back to the question of the temperature. When you showed those many big pictures of a snapshot mm-hmm. EO with the mm-hmm. coil energy mm-hmm. varying, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean the temperature was the same. So there are many more axes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is, of course, the nightmare. What Nandini is saying, that what if the temperature is varying also? Then what would happen? This will make the phase. Yeah. So the phase diagram will make no sense then. So what you have to do, and this is something Matthias and I have proposed you'll do, you have to produce this kind of thing for many, many different temperatures and then trying to combine them together in some manner. If the temperature is varying completely arbitrarily and we have no idea how it's varying, there's not much that one can do. Okay, and that may be one of the reasons why they don't put experimental points on theoretical phase diagrams. Okay. So, I mean, I completely agree with you. But if that is the case, I think talking about phase diagram in this context is meaningless.
Well, you know very well in 2 years, all of them have to put on have to produce phase diagram in 12 hours, right?
If they won their millions of dollars. What we are talking about, what Jason is talking about, is that we are all involved in a DARPA competition where DARPA wants to put millions of dollars in emulating Hubbard model in cold atom optical lattices. And what they want, you know, DARPA is a military organization. They don't fool around. What they want is a 12-hour run. They want in 12 hours the whole phase diagram out. and that's the context. But I think, you know, never mind the funding and those things. I think there's a genuine question.
Oh, yes,
we keep on talking about quantum phase transition, and this emperor may be, you know, the emperor may be naked. I mean,
someone mentioned that. I think it's pretty interesting. So to say that, well, I mean, the contestant physicists have been saying that, well, we can do that. But now they literally calling the bluff.
Right. Yes. We have not been saying it. That's the thing. Yes. But you know, I think these questions, all the questions we're discussing here, are now no longer just theoretical questions. This and this is good.
Yes.
You know, I would not call it calling the bluff. I would say this is good. That try to put your numbers on the phase. I mean, I finally understood only over the last 2 months why all this phase diagram, all these experimental results are always shown separately. Okay? And the reason is the moment you try to put them together, all these questions that we do not know the answer to become very crucial. But in a lot of numerical work, you can make some progress. It's not completely like, you know, hopeless.
Yeah, actually, I think the fact that this 10 to minus 3 already is very telling.
Yeah.
The answer should be 1.
A lot of visibility is going somewhere.
There's a lot of temperature effects, and somehow how do you get down to 10 minus 3? Yeah.
What 10 minus 3 are you talking about?
Well, it's a signal.
Contrast.
The visibility.
It should be of the order 1. It would be the ideal situation, right?
Yeah.
But this 10 to minus 3. So there's a ladder to climb. So
Matthias, do you have any better idea or a different idea of how to show the phase diagram? I mean, a variation on this probably? This is the best Vito and I could think of.
I think we have to just try how to extract the homogeneous system phase diagram from it. The kind of the deconvolution of the class or whatever.
Well, there will be experimental progress. Because as you know, what we are planning in our collaboration, and I'm sure the Harvard MIT group is going to do something very similar, we're going to use a very short trap potential. So the trap potential will be almost constant and then go up. And all the experiments will be done in the middle part, which is homogeneous. Now, whether that will succeed or not, I do not know. If that will help, the inhomogeneity effects will be suppressed, but this is, you know, has not been done.
Can I ask slightly off-topic question, since it's up on the board. The first floor, show these peaks. So
yes.
I think, you know, the first peak is due to the energy U.
Mm-hmm.
Is there maybe some experts in the audience know? I thought about this a while back also. What is the second peak due to? Is there any understanding?
This has to be a different expert in the audience. I don't even claim myself to be an expert in this subject. Jason, or...
You know, it's not understood at the moment.
So the second peak, nobody knows where it's coming from?
No. Well, no, yeah, it's not understood.
Okay. I feel slightly better.
Most people are possibly some kind of boundary between the two layers.
Matthias, do you know where this second peak is coming from?
Yeah.
That's what people are discussing. This is, everybody talks about just this. This is the second peak. As if it's not there, we pretend.
Well, the disturbing thing is they claim they can measure the frequency of the second peak. It's 1.7 something.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell from the experiment why they can have such an accuracy. I mean, at this point, I'm not taking it too seriously yet.
So that would be interesting. I mean, before you get defensive,
I completely agree.
It's a simple thing.
But this may require some atomic physics. This may be a condensed matter. This may not be a condensed matter issue at all. It could be some resonance or something. It's physics, sure. But may have nothing to do with Bose-Hubbard physics. May have nothing with Bose-Hubbard physics. Yeah.
Yes. What I heard is that the second peak should be side with three atoms.
Side
that's
three.
What you have there.
I see.
No, but,
why is that?
The point is that if it's three, then three times two divided by two. I mean, you know the
two. No,
two
to three. No, it doesn't. doesn't work.
Okay, so this has to be discussed separately then. Okay, good. Leon, you had a question or comment.
I was, again, coming back to this question of, is it interesting? I mean, there's been a lot of discussion here about, you know, everyone's plans to make $2 million and compute the phase diagram some way. My impression is that what you have in mind is nothing really different from Thomas Fermi theory. Is that correct?
You mean a local density?
Well, so you're talking about converting the infinite system phase diagram, uniform system phase diagram to a finite one.
Right. So,
And that, you know, we do that, of course, in studying an electron gas and a heterostructure or something, a diode. That's Thomas Fermi theory, is more or less.
Yeah, so that.
This standard approach doesn't bring any new physics.
Right. So what I'm talking about here is. So what I'm talking about here is that. Yeah. You have to invert it, the integral equation. But no, but the answer is yes. This part is just that. And what we are saying that needs to be done, if somebody asks, do you really know Bose-Hubbard model describes this system? You know, you have to do that and get some kind of quantitative agreement, not just schematic. Yeah, at this point, that's what he's talking about. So I do not look at it as any kind of breakthrough or fundamental understanding or anything. It's just engineering work. But it needs to be done, and I'm kind of puzzled that it has not been done. It's fairly hard numerical work because you have to invert the local density.
I would say really more than engineering work, because I think if one have an efficient algorithm to do this, and that would be that means we understand the physics, many of which we don't understand now very efficiently, because I think it's a necessary step to go to solve the 2D model. Right?
Yeah, this I agree.
If the quantum simulation and code quantum simulation that you have model, in order to get the information out efficiently and accurately, the question, how am I going to do it? How can you be sure?
This I
cannot even do that.
So basically, the way it is that what we, Matthias and I, with our experimental friends are proposing is that we're going to do Bose-Hubbard first to generate this tool. So that then when Hubbard is done, that can be used. But, you know, I mean, Leon's point is correct. This is not a fundamental breakthrough in theoretical understanding in condensed matter physics at all. We already know the phase diagram. This is validating it.
I'm not trying to make a point, just asking a question.
So that's
kind of the obvious way you would try and connect the uniform system to the homogeneous one.
Yeah.
But do you know that, you know, is it clear that works, or are there places where that might fail?
Yeah, it works. So let me just
away from the phase transition.
Yeah. So let me just go to the one figure. I'm running out of time,
but interfaces which are basically at
the here. So this is the best I can do. Again, I don't want to give away Ian Spielman's talk since he's coming here, but this is again a slide Ian made. You could see that his Mac didn't translate well into my PC, but I asked him to do his best guess of putting his points on the canonical phase diagram, and with an error bar of where he is, and you know, he feels that his density is such he's going along this line, and all he can say somewhere here is the phase changing. I mean, this is, I think, an optimistic kind of this paper is coming out in PRL. So I would say that all the indications are that it kind of works, but this is still wishful thinking level. It has to be really validated by. And I think Matthias and Vito will solve the problem.
But do they see anything special?
Yeah, they do, but I don't want to get into that. We can talk about it. I have all those data. That's like one whole talk, okay? This is all in their paper, you know, the posted on the PRL that's coming out. But let's not really. So I just want to now, I mean, time has run out. I want to tell you a little bit about something that is new, okay? I mean, Leon has a point, and the only new thing that I have been involved with that I think there is some chance of observation is a true supersolid phase in an extended Bose-Hubbard model. So the question we're now asking, everything we're talking about so far is Bose-Hubbard model with contact U interaction. So the question we asked about a year ago when that was my first project in AMO, motivated by people like Chetan and Mike Friedman, can we create an extended Hubbard model, Bose-Hubbard model in optical lattices? Can it even be done? And that was our motivation, because that was a necessary condition to create a topological phase. It turns out that topological phase needs many other things like really screwy hopping and so on, which are not difficult to find, which are not easy to find. So I'm not going to talk about that. But what we discovered was, and let me just go through some of the introductions here. So this is the ingredients in a parent Hamiltonian. You have a potential due to laser confinement, you have a contact interaction, and this is a total Hamiltonian. So this part, we know every element. What you want to do now is to go beyond contact interaction, okay? So when you want to do that in condensed matter physics, we use one-year basis. And to see if we can somehow, in the one-year basis, whether we can have a longer range interaction. And it's pretty clear what one has to do. At least to us, it was pretty clear. Let me just go to the basic physics thing, generating new Hamiltonian. So you have a tight binding model, and the contact interaction was all arising from the lowest state. So you can think of each potential well as creating a state that's combining is giving you the U. If you can go into the first excited state and use that to construct a Hamiltonian, that basis, then you have an extended state. And the point is, in condensed matter, you'll never try to do something like that, because if you put the system in this excited state, it's going to stay there a femtosecond or picosecond, come back. You cannot do an experiment. It turns out in AMO system, they stay there for about 100 milliseconds, which is not incredibly long, because there is nowhere for it to go. You know, that's how long it takes for it to go down. 100 milliseconds is not infinitely long, but it's long enough, my colleagues tell me. So now we can solve the solid state physics problem of, you have a potential well, you use the excited state, just form the solid state, you know, just solve the solid state physics problem, which you did here, to see what kind of extended interaction you can create. And so we did that. This is in our two papers. We have a PRL, and then we have a PhysRev with Eugene Demmler. And what we find, and this is the important result, that we find that we have an extended range interaction V, which of course falls off with the lattice depth, because as you're making the lattice depth larger and larger, you are this is going to be more and more localized. And that you can actually calculate the correction to U. And so now you have a model where you have T and U and V. Okay? And you can generate systematically next order and next order. Now, I should tell you, unknown to us, there are other groups which thought about this extended Hubbard model from a totally different, not connected with our motivation. They looked at polar molecules, basically dipoles, because dipoles automatically have very long-range interaction. And it's a totally different approach. And so there are two ways of creating extended range. One is do what we are talking about, which is use the next level in each well to create an extended range, or you can just have long-range classical interaction dipolar. Depending on your need, both may work. But then what we did is the obvious thing. We took this model. It's really not a model. It's a model that we have numerically calculated, and asked what the phase diagram is. And I'm going to really end with this phase diagram. And we found, and this is of course known among experts in Bose Hubbard model, people like Matthias knows this. We didn't know it. I mean, we found out when he posted our paper that's kind of known, that if you have an extended Hubbard model of this kind, then there would be a supersolid phase. There'll be a phase. So normal Bose Hubbard model with contact interaction has only Mott phase and superfluid phase, but there will be a supersolid phase. Now, let me tell you, supersolid is a very mysterious concept, and so I like to think of it as just, supersolid is two symmetry breaking together. So superfluid, you are breaking the gauge symmetry, one symmetry, and then you have a solid, you are breaking the translational symmetry, and a supersolid is nothing other than a simultaneous breaking of both the superfluid order and the translation invariant. So it's simultaneous breaking of translational symmetry and U1 symmetry. So you should think of a supersolid as a charge density wave, which is also superfluid, and that's what it is. And so that exists here. And now the question is, well, can you actually make, and it of course, it depends on the actual values of V and U. So we, in our first paper, showed that I should mention that we did a mean field Goodsweiler calculation. Because that's, all the Matthias tells me quantum Monte Carlo bosons is trivial. But we did a mean field Goodsweiler, which is easy to do, analytic, basically. And it gives the topology of the phase diagram correct, right, Matthias?
Not for this value of V, because here actually the supersolid is unstable.
Ah, okay. So the point is that experts have...
It's larger.
Right.
Then it's fine.
Right. So the point that is that there is still a quantitative question. If you are going to see it, so there is no question there will be a supersolid phase if you can create that extended Hubbard model. Now the question is that will you create it at the range of parameters where the experiments can be done and so on? And those questions are still open, but they can in principle be answered. And as far as I know, both Ian Spielman and Emmanuel Bloch are very interested in looking for it. So how can one see it? And so, so that will be the last thing. So As you know, supersolid is a very active area now. There are claims of it existing in helium, and it's a big subject. And it would be nice to be able to create it artificially, directly in an optical lattice. And how are you going to see it? Well, how are you going to see it and distinguish it so this is some of the details that I'm not going to go into, and this is what Matthias was saying, that you'll have all kind of phase separation, supersolid, all kinds of, this is the true quantum Monte Carlo result. And you can see that there are many different phases. Let's not get into these details, because for an AMO talk, that's not very germane right now. What is more germane is, can you actually see it? How can you observe this new phases? And I really do not have any great idea there. All I can show is that what we kind of did. Okay, so you know, you have time of flight. That's what you have to do. So you image them, and then you have basically two kind of techniques. You can look at the momentum occupation, and supersolid will be some kind of combination of a solid and a periodic solid and a superfluid. And so we know the superfluid mode transition looks like, and from that we can do a direct calculation, and which we did. What is the result? I'm just going to show the result. So it's basically you want to see it. You basically want to pick up, the bottom line is you want to pick up signals and the right half wave vector. So you'll have this corrugated superfluid extra signal should show up. Okay? At half the reciprocal lattice vector. If you can see these signals, you have seen a supersolid. Two problems arise. One, when you did the calculation noise correlation, you found the signals are very weak. For the same reason, it's weak everywhere. Second is, and I'm going to really end it there, it's been going on for very long. Second problem we faced was that because of the edge always has a superfluid in this system. So the bulk is a more insulator phase, edge is a superfluid phase. You may see some signal like that anyway. And how to distinguish it is non-trivial. There are ways to distinguish. So even if there is a supersolid, seeing it directly is not going to be easy, is the conclusion we came to. But Matthias thinks it can be seen easily.
I think it should be easy because
good.
See this picture in the superfluid.
Yes.
Then when you enter the supersolid, there should just be some peaks appearing at your eye.
But those peaks will be very weak. That's the problem, right? They'll be much weaker than these peaks.
On the square lattice, it will be weak. Triangular lattice, they should be stronger.
Okay, so this is something we should talk. I was very enthusiastic, but my enthusiasm has gone down. Maybe we should. Okay, and I really am going to stop there because anything I say now will be kind of so what Matthias is saying is that if there is a super solid, you will see beautiful peaks here, and the problem is that are these peaks going to be strong enough for people to conclude that yes, you have definitely seen them, maybe. Well, I'm not going to talk about the other stuff. I want to talk about the age effect because it's, I have made various points. I'll be happy to talk. I'm here until Saturday. No point in showing more results. It's already 20 minutes of our time. So let me thank you, and I'll discuss.
Just a quick question. Is there any hope of making V larger than U?
V larger than U. In principle, yes. In practice, we could not really find any direct way of doing that. I mean, in principle.
With either of the models, you mentioned the polar molecules.
Polar molecules, you cannot do that. That interaction is very weak. Yeah, but V larger than U is very hard to.
I think you'll use a beta resonance to reduce the U.
Yeah. If
the long range interaction can be just.
But that's not going to be just next nearest neighbor or anything. That's going to be many, many, many interactions, right?
Yeah. Just find a supersolid layer, right?
Oh, no, yeah, there will still be a supersolid. But I think
I'm not asking about supersolids. I'm just thinking about what space in the space of Hamiltonian.
I will give my answer, but others here may know more than I do. My answer would be that I think in principle you can make V probably larger than U, but it may not be just one V. There are many Vs, you realize that, because, and if you use Fishback resonance and in a polar, I do not see why that will just make V1 or V2 larger than U. It may make many Vs larger than U, right? Right, that's not a problem for supersolid, but it may be a problem for the extended Hubbard model, a topological phase. Okay, it's
might want to have both U and V large, but V is larger than U. You want both of them large.
Both of them large compared to T.
Compared to T, right. That's it.
So the answer is yes, but maybe not for all purposes.
Actually, I have a question. So in your mean field calculations, what the wave function looks like for the super solid phase? Because for super fluid, it's easy to understand. For chucked in the wave, it's also easy to understand. But how wave function looks like for super solid?
You mean in what the picture looks like? I mean,
yeah,
it's easy to write down the wave function, right? I mean, that's which is what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's straightforward. Then also,
just
just a product state. Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, it's literally what I said. I mean, it's exactly that.
Do
you have anything against simple? I mean, you were my student. you spent too much time in Harvard. No, it's the wave function for Goodswill and Minfield, very simple. I do not know when they do quantum Monte Carlo if there are more complications. In fact, that's when I understood that super solid is not such a mystifying thing. It's just the two things together. It's hard to visualize it, I would agree. You know, it's a thing that's moving around. But writing it down is absolutely straightforward. Other comments?
Maybe we can thank the speaker.